Welcome to the Readings Podcast, a production from Melbourne's leading independent bookstore, Readings. In today's episode, a conversation with Samantha Harvey, author of Orbital. This is life on our planet as you've never seen it before. In this spellbinding and uplifting novel, six astronauts rotate in the International Space Station. They are there to do vital work, but slowly they begin to wonder, what is life without Earth? What is Earth without humanity? Together they watch their silent blue planet, circling it 16 times, spinning past continents, and cycling through seasons, taking in glaciers and deserts, the peaks of mountains, and the swells of oceans. The fragility of human life fills their conversations, their fears, their dreams. So far from Earth, they have never felt more part or protective of it. Samantha Harvey's previous books include The Wilderness, All Is Song, Dear Thief, and The Western Wind, and a work of non-fiction, The Shapeless Unease, A Year of Not Sleeping. Her work has been longlisted for the Booker Prize and shortlisted for the James Tate Black Award, the Women's Prize, and the Guardian First Book Award. I began our conversation by asking Harvey about where the inspiration came from to set this new novel in orbit.
I'm never entirely sure how to answer this question because the origin story for this novel, and probably for most novels actually, is never that clear. But I think it probably came most clearly from looking at images of the Earth from space, particularly images that are transmitted from the ISS. So there is an ISS live camera which works sporadically. NASA has a huge array of footage from space, from the ISS. I found myself watching those and feeling very overwhelmed by the beauty of the Earth from space, the strange contradiction of things that it made me feel about the fact that this is our home planet and we live there, and it's this most sort of extraordinary thing, you know, body just hanging in space. And I began to see that as a sort of a natural environment that isn't really ever written about, an opportunity for nature writing from a completely different perspective. So I kind of entertained the idea of writing about that, and I had it in my mind, I would say, as a painting more than anything else. I wanted to try to convey in words the aesthetic of it. I didn't really have a story in mind, and it was much more to do with trying to convey the images. And I sort of gave up on the book after a few thousand words, partly because of that. I thought, I don't really know how to render a novel in such a painterly way. You know, you need a narrative, you need characters. And I also had a sort of feeling of trespass that I shouldn't be narrating from this vantage point when I have never seen it myself, and I will never see it myself. So there were a few false starts with the book, but when I came back to those few thousand words I'd written, I thought, this really has something about it that interests me. This is a vantage point that I don't see explored very much in literary realism. We see it in sci-fi and we see it in nonfiction, but not really in literary realism. So it seemed very rich territory to explore, and I found myself very consumed by all the possibilities of it, of looking back at the Earth from space, the vantage point, the experience itself of being in space, of living in orbit, and then views out beyond into the solar system and the cosmos. So once I committed to it, I was completely in, and I found it a very joyful experience to write, partly because I was writing quite a lot of it over lockdown. So it was the ultimate escape from the confines of, you know, one's own house. And also, of course, it's about claustrophobia and living in a trapped space. And so, you know, there were all sorts of resonances that made it the right book for the time that we were living in.
Of course, one can immediately sense that parallel to isolations and lockdowns. It's not explicitly mentioned, but it's very palpable. And I find it interesting that you speak to the literary and the natural in terms of how you approached the writing of this book. If you were to give people a blurb or an elevator pitch, one might think it's a science fiction book or a speculative fiction story. But I believe there is something else taking place here, something I found very profound. really the people inhabiting the ISS in your story aren't the characters per se. The characters are the Earth and the ISS itself. In your writing process, how did you go about drawing out the character of these celestial bodies, usually considered somewhat inanimate objects, and giving that distinct space for your work to drift away from science fiction?
Yeah, I mean, I always knew I didn't want it to be sci-fi. I do enjoy sci-fi, actually, reading it and watching sci-fi films and so on, but I knew that that was absolutely not what I wanted to write. There was never any conflict there. My vision for the book was always very clear. I wanted it to be literary realism. I'm not particularly concerned with genre. I think we probably pay too much attention to putting things neatly into different genres. But I'm not particularly concerned either with trying to subvert genre or do something clever. It's just looking at what the proposition of your book is, what things you want to say, where your writerly heart is with any particular book, and then exploring that. And for me, that was very much to do with the reality of the fact that we as humans have been in continual habitation of low Earth orbit for the last 24 years, which is an astonishing fact, really. You know, every single day there are human beings up there, and there's a Chinese space station now as well, which is also continually occupied. So the exhilaration of this subject matter isn't, for me, in the fictional aspect of it. It's in the reality of it. It's in the fact that what seemed very futuristic ideas about how humans would occupy space and operate in space are now not just a reality, a daily reality, but they're also becoming somewhat retro in themselves. I mean, the idea of us orbiting the Earth and in low Earth orbit is now beginning to feel a little bit dusty and a little bit 2000s.
Yeah, space and space travel does feel like something from my youth of that time that drifted away as a preoccupation.
We're now looking to go back to the moon and to go to Mars, and that's where all the energy is focused now. And I wanted to concentrate on this moment that we've had for the last quarter of a century, which has been humans in space continually, but circling the Earth. And it's this sort of attentive circling of our home planet rather than attempts to get away from our planet and to explore elsewhere. Albeit, I know that part of what has been happening on the ISS has been to prepare for missions further afield. But I found there's something really kind of quite tender and domestic about that setting, you know, that it's at once this very futuristic, cutting edge, incredibly sophisticated piece of tech. And at the same time, it's quite domestic, and it's only 250 miles away, albeit upwards and the other side of the atmosphere. But still, it's just 250 miles away. And that's not that much further away than we are from each other now. You know, I think that's an astonishing thing, that it's so close and it's so real and it's happening all the time. There are people up there and we can access their view. We, you know, you can go on the NASA website or the ESA website and find out anything you want to know about what they're doing day to day, that all of their experiments are documented, where they sleep, what they eat. It just seemed something, I was quite surprised this is something that hadn't been written about before in fiction as a piece of literary realism. It was never my intention to go down the sci-fi route, but nor to try and subvert that, just to try to find the dramatic opportunity of that setting, which is so rich in contradiction and dissonance. But, you know, I find that very interesting.
Yes, it is interesting. That space between the mundane and the awe-inspiring, both in the physical sense and the more metaphysical sense, I guess. It strikes me that there are passages of an almost sentimental, romantic aspect, the crew reminiscing about things from their childhoods, about the TV shows they watch, snacks they would have, and those differ from culture to culture, but there are overlaps and similarities. It reminds me of the experience of living in shared student accommodation, the things you turn to as a means of connecting in an unfamiliar social situation, in cohabiting. There's also a passage where the crew already aboard the ISS are assisting new arrivals with docking their shuttle to the station. And you describe them knocking on the door, calling out to one another. I found it a really powerfully moving, tender moment of such simple human connection in such a bizarre, uncompromising environment. It was really, really powerful and affecting.
Thank you. You're absolutely right. That is the magic of the subject matter, I think. This dissonance between the surreal otherliness of where they are and the complete domestic mundaneness of where they are and what they're doing there. You know, the fact that their days are very rigidly structured. You know, they get up at a certain time, you know, they do their exercise, they have their breakfast, they have their call with ground crews, then they have their experiments, and then there's lunch, and it's all very, very regimented. And they are tethered to a 24-hour clock, which is universal time, which means everything to them and also means nothing to them because they're passing through time zones continually and they're seeing 16 days and nights every day. The slamming together of all of these oddities of the, you know, the trying to live a very mundane human life in a very surreal non-human space, I think is part of the sort of the magic of the subject matter and what made it for me quite thrilling to write about, you know, and to think about what that would be like. The fact that, you know, when you're an astronaut and you're with a bunch of people and you don't know them that well and you're not encouraged to broach very personal subjects with them, you know, you've got to just be able to rub along. You've got lunch times and breakfast times and dinner times every day to talk about things. And I don't know what they talk about, but exactly as you described with the people you live with, when I was living overseas, we talked about TV programs from when we were kids and what we ate and celebrities and the kind of the universal language, things that we could talk about that were quite neutral as a group, but quite personal and meaningful to each individual. I very much wanted to bring in both of those aspects, both the awe-inspiring, incredible nature of where they are, and then the equally awe-inspiring, I suppose, mundane nature of what they have to do every single day just to get by, just to survive in this very brutal environment.
It is brutal. They undergo physical trials, but also mental challenges. And then there are the more introspective or personal challenges, the trials of the soul. There's a physical object that you introduce relatively early in the story that reappears throughout, and it's a postcard of a very famous painting by Velázquez, and it stirs pondering within one character and conversation with another. Could you tell me a little bit about the inclusion of this particular item? I feel like it's really quite key to the book in a way.
The painting is Las Meninas, a very famous and much discussed painting. And I partly included it, well, originally I included it because I really love the painting. And when I did my undergrad philosophy degree, we were introduced to this painting. We had an entire kind of lecture about it, about its opening up of several philosophical questions about objectivity and subjectivity and so on. And I've always been interested in it, you know, ever since then. And I started writing about it when I was writing this book. And then I thought, oh no, that doesn't have any place in the book. I took it out. And then later on, the more I got into the book and started to find that my writing was taking on this rather kind of acrobatic, elastic quality where I was zooming in and out of perspectives, sometimes into the characters' heads. Sometimes we're looking at them, sometimes they're looking at the earth. Sometimes we're looking past them at the earth or at the cosmos. Sometimes they are big, sometimes they are small. Sometimes the time frame of the book is quite cosmic. Sometimes it's very local and detailed. And I began to think, oh, maybe this is speaking more to that painting and to my feelings about that painting, the way that it plays with perspective. Who is looking at who is the subject, who is the object, and also the invitation of the painting to both be stuck in this room, sort of looking at the room in reflection, but then be invited out of the room through that door at the back of the painting, which is kind of calling the viewer out into the world. You know, what's going on? Why is that man there? You know, where's he going? Is he coming or going? This sort of invitation to be both claustrophobic within a scene and also to be pulled out of the scene and beyond into something that we don't know and that we can't see. All of that seemed to become more and more relevant to me. The painting is about painting as well. It's about, you know, the artist is in the painting. It's about the act of painting. You know, there's like a dab of paint in the center of the painting, which is the, you know, the red paint that he's used elsewhere in the painting. I really like the fact that it calls its own medium to attention. And I think in a way, that's what I wanted Orbital to do as well, that this is a book about the earth and so on, but it's made of words. And I'm interested in what words can do and how far they can go, how far you can stretch them. And rather than trying to apologize for the fact that it's only made of words, to sort of celebrate the fact that it is made of words, you know, this is its medium, it's sort of pointing back to itself. That is probably a hopelessly abstract analysis, but it seemed that the painting just had so much resonance for me personally in terms of what I was trying to do with the book and the invitation to question in a very open way what something is about, what is the book about, and to hold a lot of contradictions in attention throughout the book. That's what I think that painting does so wonderfully, that nobody can agree what it's about, really. And does it even matter? And I sort of wanted to, you know, point to that in the book.
Well, I believe it does just that. It's such a delicate balance, but the effect is completely mesmerizing. To illustrate to our listeners just how refined and powerful this text is, would you like to read an extract for us?
Sure.
Thank you.
At some point in their stay in orbit, there comes for each of them a powerful desire that sets in, a desire never to leave, a sudden ambushing by happiness. They find it everywhere, this happiness, springing forth from the blandest of places, from the experiment decks, from within the sachets of risotto and chicken cassoulet, from the panels of screens, switches and vents, from the brutally cramped titanium, Kevlar and steel tubes in which they're trapped, from the very floors which are walls and the walls which are ceilings and the ceilings which are floors, from the handholds which are footholds which chafe the toes, from the spacesuits which wait in the airlocks somewhat macabre. Everything that speaks of being in space, which is everything, ambushes them with happiness. And it isn't so much that they don't want to go home, but that home is an idea that has imploded, grown so big, so distended and full, that it's caved in on itself. At first on their missions, they each miss their families, sometimes so much that it seems to scrape out their insides. Now, out of necessity, they've come to see that their family is this one here. These others who know the things they know and see the things they see, with whom they need no words of explanation. When they get back, how will they even begin to say what happened to them, who and what they were? They want no view except this view from the window of the solar arrays as they taper into emptiness. No rivets in the entirety of the world will do except these rivets around the window frames. They want padded gangways for the rest of their lives, this continuous hum. They feel space trying to rid them of the notion of days. It says, what's a day? They insist it's 24 hours and ground crews keep telling them so, but it takes their 24 hours and throws 16 days and 16 nights at them in return. They cling to their 24-hour clock because it's all the feeble little time-bound body knows, sleep and bowels and all that is leashed to it. But the mind goes free within the first week. The mind is in a dayless freak zone, surfing Earth's hurtling horizon. Day is here, and then they see night come upon them like the shadow of a cloud racing over a wheat field. 45 minutes later, here comes day again, stampeding across the Pacific. Nothing is what they thought it was. Now, as they track south from eastern Russia diagonally across the Sea of Okhotsk, Japan appears in the mauve-grey sheen of mid-afternoon. Their pass intersects the narrow line of the Kuril Islands that tread a worn-out path between Japan and Russia. In this indistinct light, the islands seem to Chie to be a trail of drying footprints. Her country is a ghost haunting the water. Her country is a dream she remembers once having. It lies slantwise and slight. She looks out from the lab window as she towels herself off after exercise. Her weightless bobbing is steady and upright. If she could stay in orbit for the rest of her life, all would be well. It's only when she goes back that her mother is dead. As in musical chairs, when there's one fewer seat than there are humans who need it, but so long as the music plays, the number of seats is immaterial and everyone is still in the game. You have to not stop. You have to keep moving. You have this glorious orbit, and when you're orbiting, you're impact proof and nothing can touch you. When the planet is galloping through space and you gallop after it, through light and dark with your time-drunk brain, nothing can end. There could be no end. There can be only circles. Don't go back. Stay here, ongoing. The creamy light off the ocean, so exquisite. The gentle clouds rippling in tides. With a zoom lens, the first fall of snow on the top of Mount Fuji, the silver bracelet of the Nagara River where she swam as a child. Just here, the perfect solar arrays drinking sun. From the space station's distance, mankind is a creature that comes out only at night. Mankind is the light of cities and the illuminated filament of roads. By day, it's gone. It hides in plain sight. On this orbit, orbit 2 of today's 16, they can watch if ever they have such a stretch of time and traverse the Earth one whole round and see barely a trace of human or animal life. Their transit approaches West Africa just as morning breaks. The vast spill of day blots out every obvious human landmark to the naked eye. They pass Central Africa, the Caucasus and Caspian Sea, southern Russia, Mongolia, eastern China, the north of Japan in the blanching light. By the time night comes in the western Pacific, there's no land in sight, no cities to proclaim mankind. On this orbit, the entire night pass is oceanic and black, stealing down the mid-Pacific between New Zealand and South America, brushing the tip of Patagonia and back up to Africa. And just as the ocean runs out and the coasts of Liberia and Ghana and Sierra Leone creep up, sunrise blasts open the dark and daytime floods in. The entire northern hemisphere once again luminous and humanless. Seas, lakes, plains, deserts, mountains, estuaries, deltas, forests, and ice flows. As they orbit, they might as well be intergalactic travelers chancing upon a virgin frontier. It seems uninhabited, Captain, they say when they glance out before breakfast. We believe it could be the remnants of a collapsed civilization. Prepare the thrusters for landing.
That was Samantha Harvey reading from Orbital, her newest novel published by Jonathan Cape. Samantha, hearing you read your work yourself was even better than when I read it myself. So thank you for illustrating just how powerful this book is.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. And congratulations on this amazing work.
Thank you. Take care.
Orbital is available via all reading stores and from our website, where you'll find all kinds of other recommendations for great books, music, film, and TV. You can also sign up to eNews, who will receive our free monthly newsletter, The Readings Monthly. The Readings podcast is produced by me, Nick O'Callaghan. The show's music is by Tom Hoskins. Thank you for listening.